course, you know that to be all blues, and you also know that that's Miles Davis. Also appearing in that selection, Bill Evans on piano, Wynton Kelly on piano as well, Jimmy Cobb on drums, Paul Chambers on bass, John Coltrane on tenor sax, and Julian Cannonball Adderley on alto sax as well. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Thursday, April the 25th, and we pick up from where we left off with each other yesterday discussing terrorism. And as we saw, and I got a lot of feedback on it, as we saw yesterday, there is a tremendous emotional issue that we seem to have, calling it as we see it. And that is quite understandable. In fact, that's the whole nature of being conditioned. We are told what to think without first examining why we think what we think. One of the things that we are told to think of is our political label. What is the political label that you're wearing? And if your political label says that you are to be left of center, or this is why I say all the time, I don't pay attention to political labels, because most of the time people have no clue what the political labels mean. If I were to ask a Democrat to define the philosophy of the Democratic Party, that person would more than likely not be able to tell me. If I were to ask a libertarian, what is the philosophy of the Libertarian Party or libertarianism, it would be very hard to expect that person to come up right on point with the precise definition. So we attach labels to ourselves partly as a result of a kind of warped process. Not on the basis of what we actually are, but more so on the basis of what we perceive ourselves as being, and in some cases, what we would like to be, knowing full well we're not there yet. So when you see these kinds of schisms, it's really an expression of the degree to which we have not reconciled the two. The political label that we wear and we profess because it gives us coverage, right? As opposed to the fact that we really know in and of ourselves that we have not fully blossomed, or that philosophy has not fully expressed itself to us. We have not fully embraced it. Why? Because we simply don't know it. So it's the same thing with terrorism. There are labels that are put forward, and we just blithely take them on. And terrorism is such a thing. Because when we asked the question yesterday, what is terrorism and who is a terrorist? Well, you heard for yourselves the struggle that went on as people wrestled with the definition. But it wasn't so much that they were wrestling with the definition. They were wrestling with the psychological adjustment that has to be made in order for them to accept the definition, if you understand what I'm saying. Some people would say quite casually, oh, I'm a Marxist-Leninist. But it's not that they even understand that label. It is because that's where they've been hiding for a long time. And when you get into a discussion and you ask them to define the label that they're wearing, that's where they now have to wrestle with the distance, the vast distance in some cases, between what they're saying and what they're hoping that they are. What they're saying to impress you versus the void, the intellectual void that's there that doesn't line up with what it is they're representing as their true belief. But that's very human. We all go through that. So in the aftermath of this dreadful event on April 15th in Boston, it would be just sensible, and it's a great place to pause and conduct this kind of inventory, this kind of political inquiry into ourselves and into this term, which is used universally. We will always say publicly, I wouldn't say we will always, but for the most part, we will say, we condemn terrorism. And yet, privately, when we conduct this audit, we find that in so many ways, not only do we condone it, in some cases, we actually practice it. We do it. So we heard from President George Bush yesterday defining from his perspective as the head of state of a superpower country, his reaction in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the 9/11 attacks, 9/11/2001. And as head of state, he essentially embodies the national attitude toward what he defined as terror. And he laid out essentially how the United States, as a political entity, but also as a political culture. Hello? There's something going on there. Not only as a national entity, but also as a national political culture, how it is supposed to deal with terrorism, and by extension, brings the entire country into the fold, into national thought about terrorism. And today, we go to President Obama, who we will hear from as the head of state, addressing the nation in the aftermath of the bombings in Boston. And we will hear from Vice President Joe Biden speaking just yesterday at funeral services, memorial services for the police officer, Sean Collier, who was killed by the two suspects in that bombing. So listen very carefully, because now we are getting the current attitude toward this act of terror. Here we go.
Good afternoon, everybody. Earlier today, I was briefed by my Homeland Security team on the events in Boston. We're continuing to monitor and respond to the situation as it unfolds, and I've directed the full resources of the federal government to help state and local authorities protect our people, increase security around the United States as necessary, and investigate what happened. The American people will say a prayer for Boston tonight, and Michelle and I send our deepest thoughts and prayers to the families of the victims in the wake of this senseless loss. We don't yet have all the answers, but we do know that multiple people have been wounded, some gravely, in explosions at the Boston Marathon. I've spoken to FBI Director Mueller and Secretary of Homeland Security Napolitano, and they're mobilizing the appropriate resources to investigate and to respond. I've updated leaders of Congress in both parties, and we reaffirm that on days like this, there are no Republicans or Democrats. We are Americans, united in concern for our fellow citizens. I've also spoken with Governor Patrick and Mayor Menino and made it clear that they have every single federal resource necessary to care for the victims and counsel the families. And above all, I made clear to them that all Americans stand with the people of Boston. Boston police, firefighters, and first responders, as well as the National Guard, responded heroically and continue to do so as we speak. It's a reminder that so many Americans serve and sacrifice on our behalf every single day without regard to their own safety in dangerous and difficult circumstances. And we salute all those who assisted in responding so quickly and professionally to this tragedy. We still do not know who did this or why. And people shouldn't jump to conclusions before we have all the facts. But make no mistake, we will get to the bottom of this. And we will find out who did this. We'll find out why they did this. Any responsible individuals, any responsible groups will feel the full weight of justice. Today is a holiday in Massachusetts, Patriots Day. It's a day that celebrates the free and fiercely independent spirit that this great American city of Boston has reflected from the earliest days of our nation. And it's a day that draws the world to Boston's streets in a spirit of friendly competition. Boston is a tough and resilient town, so are its people. I'm supremely confident that Bostonians will pull together, take care of each other, and move forward as one proud city. And as they do, the American people will be with them every single step of the way. You should anticipate that as we get more information, our teams will provide you briefings. We're still in the investigation stage at this point, but I just want to reiterate, we will find out who did this, and we will hold them accountable. Thank you very much.
You know, I get asked, like my colleagues, almost every day since 9/11, why? Why? Why this terrorist phenomenon of the beginning of the 21st century? Why? People say to me, for they surely know they can never defeat us. They can never overthrow us. They can never occupy us. So why? Why? Whether it's Al-Qaeda central out of the Fatah or two twisted, perverted, cowardly knockoff jihadis here in Boston. Why do they do what they do? I've thought about it a lot because I deal with it a lot. And I've come to the conclusion, which is not unique to me, but I do it. They do it to instill fear, to have us, in the name of our safety and security, jettison what we value most and the world most values about us, our open society, our system of justice that guarantees freedom, the access of all Americans to opportunity, the free flow of information and people across this country, our transparency. That's their target. It infuriates them that we refuse to bend, refuse to change, refuse to yield to fear. The doctrine of hate and oppression, they've found out, cannot compete the values of openness and inclusiveness. And that's why they're losing around the world. The irony is, we read about these events, we experience them, but the truth is, on every frontier, terrorism as a weapon is losing. It is not gaining adherence. And what galls them the most is America does remain that shining city on the hill. We're a symbol of the hopes and dreams of the very aspirations of people all around the world.
Well, two things, as we see, if we were in high school and they say compare and contrast, if we were to do that exercise, we would see that the tone of the president immediately after the bombings was that of a head of state giving, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4 sequential report of where things stood His role is chiefly to calm the nation, to get everybody situated psychologically that while this was a terrible event, that the country had begun to respond in such a way as to restore order and calm. There was no need for people to fly off the handle, but more than anything else, people needed to feel the security that is associated with being American. The security of the nation was guaranteed, and people were proceeding in a methodical way to get at the root of the problem. However, he did say, and this was his only direct address, I should say, to the agents of the terror, that we'll get to the bottom of this. We'll get to know who did it and why. And whoever it turns out to be, he said, will feel the full weight of justice. Now, that's typically the way a head of state would speak, because he's not supposed to lose composure. The head of state is supposed to maintain a sense of absolute calm and I'm in charge. And that's the spirit in which he delivered his report. Now, you compare that to the fiery nature of the remarks of Vice President Joe Biden yesterday. And in a sense, he speaks for not only himself, but he speaks for the president or the administration. This is an attitude, he says, when he speaks, he's communicating the anger of the administration over this. Of course, he's doing it in his own particular way. But what he said can't be severed from the administration. He's speaking in an official capacity. And he's also speaking to the American people, invoking the highest ideals of the nation, even as it deals with this disaster, this catastrophe, this assault on the country. And he, in fact, says that. This was not just a localized event. This is to be interpreted, if you read between his lines, this is an assault on America. And all Americans ought to consider it as such, because the assault on one of us is an assault on all of us. He speaks to the main question as to why. Why? What could the motive be? And he answers it. He asks as if he doesn't know what the answer is, but then he gives it. Why do people do these things? Why? Well, the answer from his perspective is that these are, as he called them, twisted knockoff jihadis, basically referring to and making clear reference and inference to the association of this type of violence with an al-Qaeda type of operation. He's talking directly at the business of terror will not make America yield or bend. It cannot destroy our absolute convictions and our quote, our way of life, unquote. We talked about all these symbolic words, which have great meaning at a time like this. And he comes out swinging, as opposed to Obama's cool, he comes out swinging, saying, listen, they're trying their best to win. They're trying their best to score victory, but they know that they cannot win. And they, by the time he uses the word, he uses it understanding that we understand who he's talking about. And invoking the highest qualities, the highest prizes of being American, transparency of our government, our democratic way of life, talks about the shining city on the hill. They cannot defeat us or overthrow us or occupy us, which is to say, these things are the things that terrorists are seeking to do, to defeat, overthrow, and occupy. He talked about the fact that they will never succeed at instilling fear. And we talked about the whole idea of this is to instill fear. No matter who uses terrorism, the idea is to convey that they have the power to make you very afraid. And in making you afraid, they have succeeded, at least in a significant degree, to controlling. Well, all these are good things to pay attention to, because this is the period we're in. We're trying to decipher it and understand it. But ultimately, terrorism, as we began to discuss it yesterday, has to do with a dramatic shift, or the effort to create a dramatic shift in the power equation between those who are committing the acts of terrorism and those upon whom the act is committed. The terrorist does not regard numbers at all. These things are just par for the course. The main thing they're interested in is the psychological conquest of getting you to understand and to notice that the intent is to change the power equation, and then ultimately to get you to submit to it. That's it. Which is why you will have two guys, just two guys, going up against an entire city or an entire country. The proportionality does not matter to a terrorist. Two against 300 million plus. It doesn't even matter. These things are not part of their thinking. And so the converse is also true. As we saw, I would give you an example of the invasion of Grenada. All this stuff, all this military might against a tiny little speck of dust in the Caribbean Sea that could barely defend itself. Swatting, it's like swatting a fly with a cannon. Such are the odds against resistance. Right. So, what is our task today? We're going to be talking about that twisted relationship, because we, all of us, are caught up in it. We are inclined to condemn terrorism. We condemn it as being undemocratic. But even in routine ways, we endorse it. We accept it. And here's the kicker. We even insist upon it. We insist in many ways on this undemocratic process to assure democracy. Hello. Isn't that weird? We do. And it is not just about what the country does. It is also about what our household does, what our schools do, what our leadership does. As one of my friends used to say, in the world of hypocrites, we turn out sometimes to be the hippoist crits. That's the contradiction that we are addressing today. This twisted, perverted relationship we have with terrorism, individually and collectively. Your thoughts and comments as we take this break and begin the dialogue process right after that at 888-874-4888. Let's go and do, like yesterday, vigorous discussion and debate right after this. This is Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrace Lead, and we're continuing our discussion on terrorism, looking at the love-hate and sometimes the hate-hate relationship we have with it. Eric, you're joining us from Brooklyn.
Hello.
Hello, Eric. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What are your thoughts?
Wonderful show.
Thank you.
I was listening to, I downloaded the show from yesterday,
yes.
And I was amazed at how many people had problems when you asked them about what is terrorism, and you know, is the act that was committed on in Boston terrorism? I think it is. I think you can. I mean, you can look to some members of families terrorizing other members of families. You know, I think it hits that close to home, and that I think is committing these acts of violence and terrorizing, traumatizing people. Really, that sometimes might have nothing to do with what the goal is or what the person has in their mind. You know, about who's wronged them or why they're suffering, and. So a lot of these acts, people want to differentiate and say that no, it was a criminal act, or I think terrorism is inflicting trauma and pain and hurt on people, and happens in many forms. It's not only in form of what the government does or in form of what certain groups do in terms of Muslims or Christians or, you know.
So, Eric, I have to ask you, is there such a thing as good terrorism?
No, I don't think there's such a thing as good terrorism. You know, I think if you're trying to make a point, if you're fighting somebody, it has to be, you have to target your aggression towards a person or the people or the entity, you know? And I think that this destruction of innocent people who happen to be in the way or who happen to be around is something that's creating a lot of insanity, and it is like a circle of violence. I think that the people that want, if you have a target, why are you hurting everybody else instead of going directly to the target? You know, I think that it's a problem. I don't agree
with
that.
The thinking might be this, Eric. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you go to the target, mm-hmm. you may constantly have to go to individual targets every time something erupts. But if you were to be really good at terrorism, mm-hmm. you send a message sometimes for generations that you're not to be toyed with.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
And I understand that. I understand that concept. But I think that it never ends. If that's the way we justify it, it never ends. What the U.S. is doing in these countries, it'll never end, because there's always going to be those people that have been so wrong and that are so damaged.
You have given us a very good clue. It never ends. Thank you so much, Eric, for being our first caller today and setting the tone. Thank you so much. We go next to Ron from New York.
Oh, how are you doing, Eutrace?
Fine, thank you, Ron.
You know, I'm going to need a little help from you. Because
you're sneaky already. See, that's a sneaky move right there. All right, let's go.
The question is, the thing is this. Mm-hmm. The vice president asked the question of why, and he kept mm-hmm. asking why. And then from my point of view, or the way I see it, he went on to give motives or methods of terrorism instead of answering the question, why are they doing it? And if his answer to the question of why they were doing it is because they hate our freedoms, because I thought I heard a hint of that in the end, then now I understand why they have these new acts out, like the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. That's to relieve us of our freedoms so that the terrorists won't hate us.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think this is the first time the country has asked that very question, why? Or is it the first time that there has been this answer?
This is the same answer that we got from George Bush.
It's the same answer you're going to get from any president or vice president.
Exactly.
He's not asking why because he's looking for an answer. It's a rhetorical question. He's asking why only to give you the rationale for what would, in other words, if the country were to react, these are the reasons we will be reacting in your behalf.
Right.
All right. There you go.
Okay. So to that, the only thing that I can say is because I was on the Daily, I think it was the Daily News or something like one of those papers website, and there was a lot of replies, and a lot of the replies seemed to be, you know, in that vein about them hating our freedoms. And the only thing I have to say to them is that it must be difficult for those who take authority for truth rather than truth for authority. Thank you, Trace.
Thank you. You drop these pearls and then you take off. Well, all right. Well, excellent, Ron. Thank you so much. Hello, Reverend Johnson from El Paso. Are you there?
How are you, Trace?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, you know, I want to thank you for this great show. And, you know, one of the things that I learned from your program is that when you are a journalist in your own right, like you said, everybody now has a computer, which I'm on now, watching, listening to your show. Another man's terrorist is another man's hero. So what I'm saying is you were correct. When people are jockeying in the mass media world for the Pulitzer Prize for the coverage of these incidents, we don't know who created a dissident or where a dissident came from or why they became they were radicalized. I don't know what that really means because nobody knows better than blacks in this country about the terrorism of the John Birch Society or the KKK. We know that Jimi Hendrix was targeted by the FBI like Marcus Garvey was. So one of the things I learned from your program is that somebody's trying to get a Pulitzer Prize and sell newspapers and get people to log on to their blog and get people to buy their newspaper, and they are jockeying for the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, let me just tell you this. The much bandied around word in the past couple of days, in the past week or so, the word radicalized is meant to convey terrorism influenced by the Arab Muslim world. In the same way that the word Africanized is applied to insects and so any ferocious invasion of unwanted animal life. We had Africanized bees that used to sting people to death. We now have an Africanized snail that is, infesting America. It's Africanized. The same way radicalized is to be associated with the Arab Muslim extremist world. Thank you so much for getting us that closer to our question today. Patricia, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. As I'm listening to some of the news reports coming out of Boston, now that this young man is able to communicate in writing, if we accept what is being reported to us as fact, in fact, he has said that he and his brother did not have any affiliation with any organization. And, I was trying to explain to my aunt the other day that what has been done in our name in this country and what we accept as truth has absolutely nothing to do with the truth. So I said to her, if you think about terrorism, look at the NYPD. Are they not operating in a very terroristic manner? I mean, when you make certain that every African-American male, before he leaves his house, knows that at any given time, he can be stopped. He can be thrown against the wall. He can be charged. That's a form of psychological terror. So I may not inflict physical injury on your body, but if I inflict psychological terror on your body, that's probably even more destructive.
But here I would point out that it is that very thing that is used by the police commissioner, the mayor, and others in control of the governmental apparatus to explain the not only the efficiency of the department, but to explain that very technique with that very intent in mind is what has cut the incidence of crime way down. Well, so that it's good terrorism.
Well, I don't know that it has cut the incidence of crime down, because when you look at the statistics, when you look at the evidence, what they have extracted has absolutely nothing to do with reduction in crime. There is no evidence to support that.
But it is not meant to trigger a discussion on that level, a statistical analysis level, not at all. It is meant to convey to others to whom this particular technique and tactic are applied, to convince those others that it is necessary to exert this kind of power on a particular group so as to assure your safety. Now, wouldn't you see how easily others would embrace that without questioning whether it in fact is terror?
Unless they have personally experienced it, or someone in their family has personally experienced it.
But they're not, because the idea is to say, in a demographically changing city, where within the blink of an eye, it would be a predominantly non-white city, these are ways in which you can expect controls. So even though there's fear of being outnumbered, this is a technique that would prove and yield desirable results.
Well, to me, that's terrorism.
Of course it is, but it's good terrorism.
Oh, it's good terrorism.
Yes. The citizenry that harbors fear of being the subjects of criminal action, that somebody's going to come and rob them, will say, well, you know, hey, look, it's working, because the police department is saying that murder and violent crimes are down because we are doing this particular, taking this particular tactic.
And just one other comment, and this has absolutely nothing to do with this. This was just an aside. I woke up this morning and I didn't realize it was Take Your Child to Work Day. I turned on the television, and on MSNBC in the morning, I mean on CNBC, as you know, that is a business show, and all of the employees had their children at work. And I looked at this and I said, there were infants there, look, maybe about 6 months old, but they had toddlers all the way up to early, young adolescents. And I said to myself, isn't this an interesting way to expose your child to power so that your child internalizes very, very, at a very early age, where the power lies and how to transfer power from parent to child?
Of course. Absolutely.
Very interesting.
Well, thank you. You're very interesting. Your thoughts have certainly been very interesting here today, and thank you for contributing them.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. 888-874-4888. You see how every day, even in routine ways, we accept terrorism. We don't call it that, but we recognize that it is going on, and in many ways we accept it. Not only do we accept it, we are encouraged to insist upon it. When Vice President Biden talks about the fact that the nation is attacked because we have freedom, because we have this, because we have that, and lists a number of things associated with the shining city on the hill, he says. He knows, as should we, that that is not the reason people are attacking. Nobody's attacking the United States because it's a shining city on the hill. They're attacking for entirely different reasons. We know that. But if you frame it differently, just like this stop and frisk, if you frame it, if you give it the propaganda power and you have a compliant media continuing the message, it will condition the minds of people to accept terror, even when it is disproportionately exercised on one group of people. As long as that other group of people feels good about it, then they can accept it, and then they can rationalize it. You see? The community that is not affected by stop and frisk is not lobbying against stop and frisk. They are beneficiaries. In their minds, they are persuaded that because this is happening, you are safer. And even, quote, progressives, unquote, would adopt that way of thinking because they see themselves allied with the power structure on that point. So, yes, on a philosophical level, they would disagree with stop and frisk. On a pragmatic and practical day-to-day level, they will embrace it. It will not be part of the things that bother them from day to day. Similarly, right now, if the United States were to say, okay, we found that these guys came from the XYZ country, and we have reason to believe that many more attacks are being planned, we're taking preemptive action. Having been conditioned visually with the horror of what these bombings inflicted on unsuspecting citizens, having been told time again about the humanity of the people who responded as Americans, having been told by our head of state that we are attacked because people really wish to snatch from us the very valuable thing, which is our American way of life. I don't know any conflict in which anybody has attacked anybody else because they envy their way of life. When you stop and think about it, it is almost insulting to suggest that people go to war because they envy somebody else's way of life. That's not why people go to war. They go to war because injustices have been committed as they see them, and they have not been rectified. So we will continue to see this, and we will continue to be engaged on that level as good American citizens to endorse bad American policy. You see? That's how it works. And it goes, you know, from the ground up, from the highest levels, even to the smallest or micro level, even in our own households. We inflict terror because we love our children. We beat them. We treat them terribly. We fight with our neighbors. All these things are forms of terror that we routinely commit. But an abusive parent always would say, I did it because, you know, I want my child to go right. It's bizarre. an abusive wife would always rationalize her abuse of her husband because she loves him and wants to see him go the right way. So, is there good terrorism? And we see it all the time. We endorse it all the time. Can you think of ways in which we endorse good terrorism? Terrorism that is meant to benefit us. Terrorism that is meant to guarantee our way of life. How do we endorse that kind of terrorism when it occurs? Do we spot it? Do we condemn it? Do we move against it? What do we do? There's educational terrorism occurring in this country. Public schools are being shut down in specific neighborhoods under this president. 4,000 schools have already been closed. It's educational terrorism. In fact, it's worse. It's educational genocide. The rationale is they have to get rid of these schools because they're not performing well. Well, the logic would be, well, why not improve them? Why shut them down? And the counter to that is we're shutting them down for your own good. See, it's the rationale we have. 4,000 schools. Imagine that. More than 200 schools in the city of New York alone. And yet, New York City remains a governable town. That is miraculous because it means the message has been tolerated. The argument suffices. It makes sense to enough people to convince the other people to whom this thing is actually happening to just shut up and tolerate it. It's terrorism. A majority population says, we're down with that. You and your kids and whatnot, you know, we're not responsible. That's your fight. But we think it's a good thing. It's terrorism. But we don't see it that way. We don't react to it that way. We're quick to talk about it as a political phenomenon. Terrorism is always political. It's happening every day. And we tolerate it. And in some cases, we actually encourage it. And how do we encourage it? We encourage it by silence. We encourage it by inaction. We encourage it by intentional ignorance. Not that we don't know. We don't even want to know. We insist on not knowing. That is the kind of terrorism that we have to deal with and that we practice every day. So the next time that people start talking about terrorism and confine it to, you know, a bunch of shadowy people walking around with bombs or doing other things to kill off as many of people of the people they view as the enemy to get a larger point across, that's a super simplistic understanding of it. Terrorism is occurring at the very micro level, and we encourage it. In fact, we insist on it by our silence. It may be as close to us as our household. Well, I want to thank you for your participation today, and we'll round out the week on this subject. We'll take a look tomorrow at another aspect of terrorism. And we talk about politics tomorrow, serious politics and this business of terrorism and the opportunity at this very point, the opportunity to do things that can change the outcome. that can persuade a new way of thinking about this, and that certainly can reorient us on the subject so that we're not just pawns, you know, like lemmings. We do what people tell us to do. We have a brain. We can independently assess the situation and decide where our interests lie. So thanks so much for being with me today. I really consider myself privileged to be in your company. See you tomorrow and spread the word. This is the place to be every day, Monday through Friday at 1 o'clock Eastern. Thank you.